On this episode of Big Boys Don't Cry, we discuss the film Coming to America. You don't have to have seen the film to enjoy the podcast, but it probably helps if you have seen it, as there are some spoilers and discussions of the content. So if you do proceed, just be aware that if you do listen, the film Coming to America will probably be spoiled for you. Enjoy.
Hello, hello.
Hello. I can see your face. Quick, turn it off. There we go.
That is generally the reaction I get when people see my face.
Oh, God. It's monstrous. No, I'm joking. You're very handsome.
Oh, well, thank you very much. I appreciate it. We are a pair of handsome gentlemen, I think.
Definitely. Which is why we're doing this on a podcast and not on a YouTube channel.
I do wonder whether at some point we should do like a Big Boys Do stream.
Yeah.
Or something along those lines.
One of my favourite podcasts, Back to Work, with Merlin Mann and Dan Benjamin. It's like mostly a tech and productivity cast, but they're very cool guys and it's very funny. They always like do it live and then do it live. And then people like type up comments and stuff. They don't really engage with the listeners, but it's always like you know that you could... Or is that a lot of people do tune in live, like it's like a live radio show. But I also like the fact
with
ours that I can edit out anything stupid that I say. Not that I've ever had to do that, or have I? Who knows?
It's true. You never say anything dumb. I do worry about the content that I sometimes come out with.
Yeah. Hashtag content.
Hashtag brand.
Hashtag globe exit. I still can't quite work out what that's supposed to mean from the flat earthers. It's like, are they saying we should, like, the globe should exit some kind of greater confederation that is stopping it from being, you know, able to choose its own destiny to go down the toilet? Because it seems, if it's supposed to be like a Brexit type analogy, it just seems like it doesn't work.
Yeah, I think there's many things which are confusing about the flat earth theory, but that is one of the main ones that's a real head scratcher. I read it more as the theory of the globe should be exited from discourse,
right?
And then instead we're on a flat plane.
You should exit the globe theory from your mind.
Yes, exactly.
Exit pursued by a globe.
Exit pursued by David Icke.
Yeah. Well, as we heard on last week's podcast, his footballing career actually was pretty feeble. So I don't think he'd be able to chase you that far, especially not now as well. He's quite old now, isn't he?
He is, yeah. Yeah, because I didn't know to what extent he'd got through. I know he started at Coventry as a youth prospect, but I didn't realise it went that far downhill for him so quickly.
Yeah.
So he's clearly found his calling in calling out the lizard men.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, yeah. He's obviously somehow making a living off of it, isn't he?
Yeah, I think like it must be, if you come up with a theory captivating enough, it must be quite easy to then make money off the back of it. And he's clearly got that nailed down to a T.
Yeah.
Not that I'm suggesting that he doesn't believe everything he says, but he's managed to create this legacy of content that other people find incredibly appealing.
That's the thing. You just have to convince people that you believe it. And then that seems to have its own kind of magnetic pull, doesn't it? Conviction is an attractive quality on a personal level. And I think that's actually part of the reason that the flat earth theory has gotten so far, is that some people are so... Their conviction that the earth is flat is so huge that it seems to rub off on other people who are impressionable.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. It's one of those things where if enough people shout about it long enough, it stops becoming a lie and starts becoming the truth.
Yeah. Billie Jean is not my lover.
It's just a girl who said that the earth was a globe.
And the kid is not my moon. I was editing the, because we record our podcast ahead and it's quite a weird schedule. I was editing the William and Kate episode earlier. That's a good episode. Some great stuff in there. A lot of stuff.
I enjoyed chatting about it. I'm looking forward to listening to it back.
Yeah, me too. We can definitely listen back to that one and have a lot of fun. How have you been since, did I speak to you on Monday? A few days?
Yes, yeah. I've been all right. I've been very excited about the new Nine Inch Nails EP, which has dropped.
Oh yeah.
And it's very, very cool. It's very, very different. There's some very bold choices that have been made in terms of like songwriting and stuff like that. So yeah, I'm all over it. I'm giving it a few listens over.
Cool. He's just a machine, isn't he? Apart from that, isn't
he? He is, yeah. He went through many years of like not releasing new material for like 5 years at a time. And then recently he's just been powering through. So he's been releasing like various very critically acclaimed albums, also getting Oscars for soundtrack work, getting Oscar nominations for other soundtrack work. And now he's released two EPs in the space of about 6 months, 7 months of each other.
And he always seems to do it just at the point where you think, oh, Nine Inch Nails haven't released anything in a while. And then suddenly there it is.
Yeah, exactly. I think they're very clever from a business angle.
Yeah.
Trent Reznor and the various people that he works with. They really got it nailed down in terms of business. And they always seem to be very much on the cusp of what makes things exciting from a business side. So a few years ago, they released an entire album for free. And it was one of the first bands to kind of do that in that way, particularly of that sort of like caliber of artist as well.
I remember that really, really well. I mean, I've never been like a massive fan. I think I like a couple of their songs. I appreciate what they do. But I think I had a friend at the time who was super into them and was saying that they released their album for free. And I was like, you what, mate? That is the stupidest thing I've ever heard. Way back when.
And one of the most interesting things they actually did was they released all of like the multi-tracks for various albums online for free. And then set up this whole website for people to then remix it and share their remixes of songs.
That's right, yeah.
Which is really interesting. I don't think it's still around. I think it then got shut down eventually. But it was fascinating. You could go to this website and there was hundreds upon hundreds of remixes that had sort of been, and then they had voted on, so you could pick out the ones that like the community had thought were the best and stuff like that. And some of them were really brilliant.
That's wicked. That's a really good example of participatory culture in the digital age, as academic eggheads like to call it. Talked about that in my PhD.
I just liked them angry electronic songs. They were well good.
Yeah. They were well good. Yeah. Are well good still.
Yes.
Cool. But this is a film podcast. We're here today to talk about the film Coming to America, as suggested by my dad, good old MJ. So it's a request. We're slowly working our way through the requests. All the others are marked up as requests on the list, so if you've made a request, we'll get to it eventually. But yeah, I jumped on this one as my choice because I think I had vaguely heard of it, but I definitely never seen it. And it's an 80s black rom-com, and I thought that was a good place for us to go in terms of discussing a broader spectrum of films. And I like Eddie Murphy. I like the 80s. You know, I thought it was going to be good. What did you make of it?
It's a movie that I remember really, really enjoying when I was younger. In that kind of very much an 80s comedy spectrum. And I did enjoy it a lot. And there's lots of things about it that I really enjoy. And I think there's a lot of great one-liners and stuff like that. But yeah, I'm not sure if I enjoyed it as much as I did when I was younger.
No, as I have to say, as someone seeing it for the first time now, I didn't get very much enjoyment out of it. Like you said, there were a lot of lines that were good and there were some very funny moments of physical comedy, but on the whole, it felt very, very dated and in a number of different ways to me. And it wasn't that easy to watch. Whereas I suspect that if I had seen it when I was younger, I'd be looking back on it a bit more fondly, but I was only really focusing on the negative things, which is a shame, obviously, because it is a good and enjoyable film, but in many ways. But yeah, it was very, very hard for me, I think, even after the first sort of 5 minutes, because it opens quite strongly and quite funnily, but it really, really dropped into a really, really stereotypical portrayal of Africa that just was really offensive, and I couldn't get past that. What do you reckon?
So what? I'm not sure how much I agree about the portrayal of Africa, in as much as it's like a send-up of it. And it avoided quite a lot of... What I do like about it a lot is that it avoids lots of the stereotypes of Africa being a poor continent that were very pervasive in the 1980s in particular. So you've got all these incredibly affluent people from this nation in Africa. And there's none of the sort of like starving kids and stuff like that, which was really sort of like the Western conscious thought of Africa at the time.
Yeah.
Which I did like. And I thought of it more as a send up of ideas of Africa more than a direct portrayal of this is what's funny about African culture.
Yeah, I think throughout it was walking that line very, very carefully. And at times I felt like it was on the send-up side, and at times I felt like it wasn't. And it was, it was hard to work out for me. I felt a bit conflicted, as you said, like I thought it was sending it up, and sometimes it just felt like, oh, every time it's Africa, there's like elephants and lions and tigers and stuff. And then later on, when the guy, the douchebag guy with the hair, who is quite a funny character, to be fair, he's like making jokes about Africa being poor, and like you guys riding lions and tigers and stuff, and then it's like, when he's doing that, it's bad, but when like the film is doing it as a whole, like, then it's okay to laugh at it. And I found that a little bit difficult to reconcile.
Oh, fair enough. Yeah, I didn't sort of read it in that way at all. I think the way that it talks about Africa is actually a lot more clever, and I think it's more sort of like, I think it's more poking fun at ideas of Africa in Western culture than it is poking fun at African culture without that knowledge of what Africa means. Because this is a film that sort of like, this is long after the heyday of the adventure movie and the adventure novel that really sort of like had that core racist idea about savage Africa and natural Africa and things like that.
Yeah.
And instead I feel as though it's kind of like beyond that, sort of like doing just sort of like almost, because the Africa that they portray is more sort of like of a utopia in comparison to New York.
Yeah.
And I think it kind of has, I think it's much more subversive than it is being deliberately offensive based on ideas of Africa as a continent.
No, I don't think it was being deliberately offensive at all. I think perhaps it's just the way that it was put together. If you were doing that now, you'd probably be a lot more culturally sensitive. And perhaps I'm being overly culturally sensitive because of the way things are now. Looking at it with a 21st century hat, you know, and you know, ultimately our criticism of this is probably less valid than black people's criticism of it, because it's a black film, it's made by black people, the cast is pretty much all black, and it's a black story. So, you know, don't listen to what I say. If black people enjoy it, then that's probably a lot more valid. It's what you're probably better off listening to their criticism than mine.
Yeah, I think that's probably fair to say for both of us.
And I read a fair amount of criticism from around the time, or did a bit of background research, because I was interested to see how it was received at the time. And it seemed like it went down very, very well with the black community in the US especially. And part of the reason for that was that there actually hadn't been that many films up until that point with an all-black cast made by, you know, mostly a black writer and that kind of thing. It just hadn't been done that much, and the testimonials from a lot of the older actors, like the guy who played the love interest's dad, Mr. what's the Faco McDonald's fake McDonald's called?
Oh,
McDowell's. Yeah.
Amos.
Yeah, Mr. McDowell. The he said that, you know, had 25 years in the biz, he'd never seen half as many black people on a film set and that kind of thing. So that's very, very good and very positive out of it. I just feel like, yeah, it felt very, very, very 80s, and that people would have been more sensitive if it was made now, which I think when you watch a film, an old film now, having never seen it, it's hard to disentangle yourself from thinking how they would do it now, I guess.
But I don't think this movie has that kind of reputation of as having grown outdated over time. I've read very little, even in terms of modern criticisms of the film, that kind of point at it as being a sort of racist archetype at all, or stereotypical at all. It seems to have completely avoided that kind of criticism.
Yeah. No, it definitely has. So yeah, I couldn't find anything that was really tearing it to shreds or anything like that. So, yeah, I think I just found it difficult to completely... I don't know. I guess I'm just being too culturally sensitive. Yeah.
Yeah, I wouldn't worry too much about it. I don't think anyone who matters, whose opinion about this, seems to think of it as being negative portrayals. It's hardly Ace Ventura 2. Towards Africa.
I don't believe I have seen that. I remember watching the first one quite fondly, but I don't believe I ever saw the sequel.
The Ace Ventura movies are a pair of incredibly hilarious movies that happen to have some awful, awful stereotypes in both of them. So in the first one, there's quite a lot of transphobia.
Yes.
With regards to the villain.
Yep.
And then the second one, Ace Ventura goes to Africa, and it kind of goes exactly as you'd expect from an Ace Ventura movie that goes to Africa.
Yeah. It's a shame, because I really, really like Jim Carrey, and I think he's very funny. And if you've ever seen any of his like early stand-up, like there's some clips on YouTube, he's absolutely sensational. Like, he could have actually just had an amazing career as a stand-up, and that would have been it, but he wanted to act.
And he made some of the funniest movies of the 90s in the process, so, you know, it's all right.
This is true, but Ace Ventura 2 is not one of them, you're saying.
Well, it is very funny. It's just marginally problematic.
Yeah.
Whereas Coming to America very much cleverly toys the line of what's tongue in cheek and what's not. Ace Ventura 2 more sort of like goes towards the Indiana Jones style, sort of using previous templates of locations.
Right.
But kind of goes for a swing and a miss, whereas Indiana Jones does it in a much more interesting way.
Cool. But yeah, there were a lot of things that I did like about it, like the score by Nile Rodgers. That was really great, especially when they got to the US and then suddenly it started to become all funky and 80s and stuff. I appreciated that quite a lot.
Yeah, it's got a really clever score, this film, and it works very well. It's also an incredibly 80s feeling score too. It kind of sets the timeline of this movie incredibly well.
Yeah, and going to Queens is quite significant as well, because nobody went to Queens back then. It was seen as just kind of a really rough area, whereas now it's like the hipster place where people are all moving to because they can't afford to move to Brooklyn and it's all gentrified and stuff. But Queens in 1988, my limited understanding is that that would have been an authentically rough area. So he's all happy and he's singing or whatever, and someone shouts "fuck you" and he goes "yes, fuck you too." That probably would have actually happened.
Yes, yeah. I don't think it would have been quite as jovial either. There would have been further altercations off the back of that.
Yeah. Let's see what else. I found as well that the comedy throughout was a little bit flat as well. It seemed to rely on like sort of predictable one-liners and strange gags and set pieces and things. A lot of the scenes just went on a little bit too long. But there were a lot of isolated things that I did laugh at. But yeah, for me, a lot of the comedy was a bit wooden, and especially it felt like the Eddie Murphy show. But I prefer just seeing him do stand up because it feels a lot purer than him trying to put on lots of different guises and try and play lots of different characters that don't quite always work, or where it doesn't really service the plot in any way. Yeah, a lot of the comedy fell flat for me as well. I didn't hate it. I'm not here to hate on it, but yeah, I did find that a lot of the comedy didn't quite land with me either. What about you? Were you lolling?
Yeah, I feel like it. I do agree with you in terms of what I found doesn't work necessarily about Coming to America is the overall plot now feels very, very generic.
Yeah.
And like you've seen it time and time and time and time again. And you don't really get any sort of emotional impact or tie to any characters outside of how funny they as an individual are. And that's kind of what propels your want for these characters to succeed, is how funny they are. You don't get sort of like, there's no kind of sympathy for anybody in the movie, I found.
Yeah.
It's all bounced around, oh, these people are really funny. I want to see more of them. I want to see them succeed. So much so that, like, you don't necessarily want James Earl Jones, who plays Eddie Murphy's dad, who is the king. You don't necessarily want him to succeed, but you just want to see more of him because he's so great as like the straight man in this film.
He was very, very good performance as the kind of stern, slightly concerned, but yeah, uptight dad is great. And obviously with his voice, it is really, really hard to get Darth Vader out of your head as well.
And they play upon that as well. So there's something later on where James Earl Jones, King Jaffe, he turns up to come and find his son in Queens, and Mr. Mr. McDonald's, Mr. McDowell, he's like, oh yeah, well, I'll go tell him you're here. And James Earl Jones says back to him, it's like, oh no, I will deal with him myself. And it's just like a straight play on the lines that he used in the Star Wars movies.
Yeah, that's definitely intentional.
And sort of so they're building upon his reputation, because at this point James Earl Jones has this reputation as being like a real hard nut character actor. He's done it time and time again by this point in his career. And yeah, they sort of knew exactly how to utilize him in this film in an incredible way.
Yeah.
And in general, I think that the cast is in this film. Wouldn't you agree?
The cast is what?
Is great.
Oh yeah, yeah, definitely. I mean, Eddie Murphy's really good. I feel almost a bit, I don't know, I wonder about Eddie Murphy, because he obviously made a lot of really, really cheap nonsense in the 2000s. And when I think we were in our teens, he was that guy making all of these really, really goofy, stupid films that we quickly realised were kind of dumb, and didn't realise that he had all this really, really great stand-up behind him. So I feel like he's done a lot of crap, so it's hard to take him seriously. But he is actually really, really good, and his performance in this as the kind of just smiling away, quite quiet and lovable, affable prince who, to be fair, you know, isn't buying the misogyny of his culture that wants him to just marry a woman and treat women as objects. You know, he wants to find a woman for her intellect. So there's a slight, you know, he's slightly ahead there, I guess. But yeah, he's very good in that role. And Arsenio Hall was very good as well. I feel like I haven't seen him in much other stuff, and I feel like I want to try and see more of him, because I feel like he's probably quite funny and didn't get to shine in this film with its slightly lumpen script.
Yeah, I think he's very funny, and I think what he went on to do, he did sort of like he's done lots of like hosting of talk shows and things like that.
Yeah.
Over the years, so he's kind of gone down a very different route to Eddie Murphy. But yeah, he's very, very funny in this.
That's cool.
John Amos is great as Cleo McDowell.
Yeah. What else has he been Madge in? Sinclair, if anything.
John Amos. The thing that I recognize him the most from Die Hard 2, where he plays the once thought of as being good guy, but actually not good guy general. In the film, but that's what I recognize him from. But he's been in loads of stuff over the years, and yeah, so he was in The West Wing, for instance, was another thing that he was in.
Of course, that's where I recognize him from.
So he was absolutely great in it. It's just a really, really good cast overall. The one thing that I loved was, and that I didn't realize when I was a kid, obviously, was that the landlord, played by a guy called Frankie Faison, he's the commissioner in The Wire, the police commissioner in The Wire.
Oh yeah, jeez, I didn't make that connection either.
Oh my god. It's a really nice movie in terms of looking at actors and being like, oh wow, you're in this and you're in this, and particularly if you haven't seen it in a few years, if you only saw it when you're a kid, it's quite interesting to watch back and just look at like, oh, these are all these people that went on to do really cool stuff.
Yeah. And people who went on to great things, similar to Marie Antoinette last week, actually not on, quite on the same scale, because that's 2006. It's only 11 years ago versus 29 years ago. It's the same age as us, that film, but still a lot of people went on to do great things. And that's always nice when you can look back at it.
Yeah, and one of the things that I find very interesting about this film as well is Eddie Murphy's performance in it is very un-Eddie Murphy-like, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So even by this point, Eddie Murphy sort of like, he's known as sort of like the sassy, fast-talking character. So in Beverly Hills Cop or in Trading Places, he's got this real sort of like energy to him and real sort of like heart to his characters. But then in this, he's much more reserved. And so there's still quite a lot of that kind of physical humor involved, particularly when it comes to his facial expressions and things like that. But it's more reserved in general, I think, than you perhaps expect from him.
Yeah, I think energy is the right word there. And I think I felt like at times I wanted the energy that he has in Beverly Hills Cop and Trading Places, and it just wasn't there, even though he was obviously kind of trying to do sort of downplay it and play it as more of a straight man type character who's just looking to find his bride, you know, and to connect with a woman on an intellectual level. It's a character that is deliberately written not to demand that kind of energy, but it's still, I think, to bring that kind of energy might have helped the comedy of it. But like you said, the facial expressions are really good. It's really good when just after they start working in McDowell's, he's mopping and she's like what's her name? Lisa McDowell, the love interest. She's just at the like office computer and he's just going up and down the corridor past her with this huge grin on his face, just mopping like over and over. And that tickled me just because he had a very funny face at that point.
Yeah, that made me laugh a lot as well. It's a more subtle performance than you perhaps expect from him, but he does handle it incredibly well.
Yeah.
He is really good in this movie. And one thing that I forgot to mention, by the way, when I was listing the other actors, was this movie has a great Samuel L. Jackson cameo.
Yes, of course. Yeah. Samuel L. Jackson, who was probably big enough to be able to turn down a role as a guy who shoots up a McDonald's at this point, but did it anyway.
Yeah, it's Samuel L. Jackson's career is quite a funny one, really, because he's gone through sort of real peaks and troughs, and sort of like the real boom era for him was based off your favorite director, Quentin Tarantino.
Quentin Tarantino.
yeah. I know that you love. I love his Quentin.
Can't get enough. Anyone who doesn't like it is an inglorious bastard.
By this point, Samuel L. Jackson had been around for about a decade, I'd say, but he'd really been in very, very minor roles. It's kind of par for the course for him being the sort of like the robber in this scene. Pretty soon after this, he had roles in like Goodfellas, and a minor role in that, and like minor roles in films like Patriot Games and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Before you had sort of like big breakout roles in films like Menace to Society, that minor role in Jurassic Park, roles in True Romance.
Attack of the Clones.
So this is like just before he became a huge deal in popular culture.
Yeah.
But it's like, it is like a peak Samuel L. Jackson performance.
It is,
just for the
yeah.
brief minutes that he's on the screen. He's great. He's great.
He says motherfucker, doesn't he?
I believe he does, yes.
Yeah.
As he should.
Yeah. I mean, his peak is still obviously Snakes on a Plane.
That's true.
Me and Adam went to see that in the cinema.
Snakes on a Plane. Did you?
Guildford Odeon.
Wow. Did I see it? I think I saw it in the cinema as well. There's nobody else there.
Yeah. There was about us, and then there was about, I think there was us, and then I think there were two other blokes, like sitting in the very front, and we were sat at the back. And then when he did the line about the motherfucking snakes and the motherfucking plane, we all cheered really loudly.
Snakes on a Plane is the number one reason why internet nerds should never be trusted with anything.
Yeah.
Because running up to the release of Snakes on a Plane, internet nerds kind of took over almost the production of the movie. And sort of like being like, yeah, you need to call it Snakes on a Plane. You need to be like really silly. And you need Samuel L. Jackson to say, I've had it with these motherfucking snakes on this motherfucking plane. And so they scored. And so the producers and the directors were like, yeah, all right. It seems like there's quite a big pull for this kind of silly, over the top action-y crime movie that also includes snakes on a plane. So let's kind of roll with it and let's do something silly with it. And then none of the people who were calling for this movie to exist went to go see it at the cinema.
Yeah.
They just didn't go and see it. So it's like, no, don't listen to these people. Just make the movie you want to make.
It's the pre-social media version of Boaty McBoatface, isn't it?
Yeah. Snakes on a Plane is Boaty McBoatface. Yeah. Snakey McSnakeface.
Or it's like Brexit, isn't it? Something where you should never listen to the general public on anything because they haven't got a fucking clue.
But what I would recommend is if we put Boris Johnson and Michael Gove on a plane full of snakes, though. I think that would solve both issues.
Well,
and then filmed it.
The Tories are snakes, so you know, you just have to get the whole cabinet onto a plane and then there you are, job done.
I'm afraid there is a difference between the reptilian overlords and snakes, Paddy. I'm sorry to break it to you.
Oh really? But, okay. I obviously need to be educated.
You have an image. They are vaguely humanoid in size and stature.
Right. I get, well, what do I know? I'm just a globe cuck. Good times. But yeah, this was a very, very good Samuel L. Jackson performance. And I did enjoy the kind of stick fight, how it called back to the days when they were like fighting with the staves in Africa. And then they come, and that turns out to be useful in the restaurant. That was predictable, but still enjoyable when they took the rubber down.
Yeah, there was quite a lot of good sort of like callbacks to previous scenes and previous themes in the movie. And I think that sort of like it's because it comes from a very established director who knew very well how to put together a good comedy movie. So this was directed by John Landis.
Yeah.
Who is one of the all-time greats, particularly of 80s comedy.
And he worked with Eddie Murphy quite a lot.
So, like, he did, yeah. So he worked with him on Trading Places as well. You know, he directed Michael Jackson's Thriller as well.
Mm-hmm.
He's a great director. But he directed, like, a huge number of the most funny films in the 1980s. So like he did the Blues Brothers, mm-hmm. did an American Werewolf in London. He did Trading Places. He did Spies Like Us, Three Amigos, Coming to America. And it's just like, wow, this guy's got a really huge back catalog of amazing films here. And I'm not too sure whether I think that Coming to America is one of his best.
No, I mean, that's
when
the
I
thing.
Watched it as a kid,
He's when you listing all those films, it's like that's so many great films. It's amazing that he managed to fit all those into one decade.
Yeah, and I think like when I was a kid, I remember liking this, maybe not as much as Three Amigos, for instance, or Trading Places, but I remember still liking it a lot. But that sort of like initial reaction when I was a kid kind of rings true now, in that like I could rewatch Three Amigos at any given moment and still laugh my ass off at it.
I have and the not same seen that since
Blues Brothers.
I don't know when.
It's still incredibly funny. It's brilliant. And I could watch An American Werewolf in London at any time. The Blues Brothers is still, I think, one of the most funny comedy movies ever made.
Yeah.
If only for the car chase of all of the police cars that then just go flying off the road for no apparent reason. It just makes me laugh every single time.
Yeah. I always love the scene where they're playing that gig. They show up and it's obviously the wrong gig. It's like, yeah, are you the good old boys? Yeah, we're the good old boys. And they have like the screen, the like metal screen in front of them, because they know that all the like drunk rednecks are just going to like bottle them. I often think that if we could play when we do shows with behind that kind of screen, it might give us some kind of edge or make us look cool or whatever. But yeah, that always makes me chuckle, that scene.
Yeah, it's really funny, isn't it? It's really good. And then when the actual good old boys turn up and they form yet another enemy for life.
Yeah.
It's really something, that film. Yeah, if you haven't seen Blues Brothers,
man,
A, what's wrong with you? B, go watch Blues Brothers immediately. Pause this podcast because you want to come listen to the rest of it. But first, go and watch Blues Brothers.
Yes, do. An absolute classic. Is there a terrible remake of that? Did I imagine that?
I don't know about that. They did do a terrible sequel, which was directed by John Landis.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he did direct that.
Blues Brothers 2000, was it?
Yeah, Blues Brothers 2000.
Right. By which time, John Belushi was dead, right?
He was, yeah.
Yeah.
So it was, you know, one of the reasons why you should never make the movie in the first place.
Yeah.
And yeah, it did not go well.
Yeah. No, that is a great, great film. And stars Dan Aykroyd, who was great in Trading Places as well.
He was. And believes in conspiracy theories.
Oh, really?
So, you know. Ooh, yeah, he's a big alien believer.
But not a flat earther.
I don't think he's a flat earther, but he is like proper into aliens.
Cool.
He's, yeah, really, really, really into aliens in a way that's kind of unnerving.
I think aliens are one of the more benign conspiracy theories, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, you've got to love him. He is a lifetime member and official Hollywood consultant for the Mutual UFO Network.
Oh, okay. I think if you put the word mutual in front of something, it makes it sound official, even though no one really knows what it means in a context outside of referring to mutual friends.
Yes. Yeah. And he considers himself like a spiritualist as well. So he's got quite a lot of... I believe that Dan Aykroyd in another universe is living in a trailer in the middle of Arizona with like surrounded by CB radios.
Yeah.
Trying to hook into radio waves.
He's picking up all the signals.
Yes, exactly.
So, can we talk about the fact that the band in Coming to America is called Sexual Chocolate?
Yes, we can.
It's a shame that
they
didn't do like a tie-in single to go with it, did they? They did do, there was some music that wasn't there, but it wasn't Sexual Chocolate.
Yeah, they had one song, didn't they? I was hoping that there'd be some kind of Todd Rivers' one-track Lover from Garth Marenghi's Dark Place tied in, where Sexual Chocolate have just one incredible single. Yeah. I'd buy on vinyl, you know. If it was available, I'd totally buy that.
Yeah, you'd own that. Hang it up, put it in a frame, you know.
But how do you think Sexual Chocolate compare to... Dragon Sound from the Miami Connection.
Oh, there's no contest between them and Dragon Sound, because they've got two songs. So yeah,
they do. They have Against the Ninja and Friends for Eternity. I think the other one's called, isn't it?
Yeah, something like that. Could we get away with talking about the Miami Connection? Is there romance in there? Or is it just
there
lots
is
of
literally 5 seconds of romance. It is purely a crutch for one of the fights between the different groups. For those who don't know what the Miami Connection is, it's this amazing piece of film history.
It's wonderful.
Where it's this movie that was written by, directed by, and starring this martial arts like supremo, which was released back in 1987. It appeared in cinemas at the time, very locally to where they were based, for about a week or so, and then faded into obscurity immediately and was forgotten about. And then this cinema bought a film reel in a blind auction, not knowing what it was. And it happened to be this movie that had been forgotten about for over 20 years. And it's amazing. It's like this perfect piece of 80s B-movie charm. And it's become this huge cult classic overnight in the same vein as The Room.
Yeah.
And it has the best, worst plot I think I've ever seen in a film. So it's this rock band who are also Taekwondo masters, who are also all grad students at a university.
And all live together in the bro house, where they all have like hugging bromance, like bro time, and all talk about their feelings.
Yeah, they all have a nice shirtless bromance sessions constantly. And then they end up getting embroiled in this drug gang war between like a motorcycle gang and a bunch of ninjas. And it has to be seen, because just describing it doesn't do it justice in the slightest. It's incredible. And yeah, the gang of heroes, they're in this band called Dragon Sound, which have two songs that are played during the movie and have since been on to be released.
And they play them live in the film, don't they?
Smash. They play them live with quotation marks around it, but they were both written by one of the members of the gang as well. So like this guy legit in real life wrote these songs, and they're bloody beautiful. They're wonderful. So seriously, go and watch the Miami Connection. I'd love for us to be able to talk about Miami Connection on this podcast. I think maybe we could do a couple of bad movie ones where we talk about The Room and Miami Connection.
Yeah, this is going to be our kind of After Dark bonus episodes thing.
Yeah, we've got some bonus episodes on the go. We can talk about bad movies.
But the Room, you really, really cringe at The Room, don't you? Because it's so excruciatingly awful. Whereas Miami Connection, it's quite jovial. It's like everything is so cheap and cliched that it comes out the other side. But because there's so much kind of goofy fighting and stuff, it doesn't feel so serious. Like with these guys wanted to make like a hot action film, and it's got a real kind of energy about it. Whereas The Room is really downbeat and drab, and it's so, like, the story behind The Room is so amazing because it's so much about this one guy's incredibly flawed, weird vision. And that comes across really well, but in a way where it's so much about one person. It's like when someone's telling you about their dream that they had last night, you know? It's so much about the person, whereas Miami Connection feels like more of an engaging team effort, so it's slightly easier to watch and is more funny. Yeah, this is the kind of thing we'll talk about on the After Dark thing, but Miami Connection is really, really great. It's really worth seeing. I think if you couldn't stomach The Room, you'll be able to stomach Miami Connection. It's great.
What I love about The Room is that it almost feels like the kind of movie that would be shown in the background on Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
It's got that kind of thing going on where you're just like, oh yeah, I could see this being in some kind of weird-ass, twisted soap opera otherworld.
Sipping a cup of coffee. You're tearing me apart, Lisa.
You went a bit Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Yeah. Tommy Wiseau's accent is impossible to do.
It is. It's great. I mean, The Room is incredibly cringy, but I think it kind of like I've watched it so many times now that it's surpassed the cringe factor and is now just back into pure enjoyment.
Yeah. Like once you can more or less say every line back to yourself, then it's, yeah. A film occupies a special place in your head and your heart when it gets to that point, no matter how terrible a film it is.
Yes, yeah. And it's truly something else. But yeah, Miami Connection kind of like has that same thing going on where it's so bad it's good, but it seems to come from a much more good-natured place than The Room.
Yeah. I genuinely catch myself singing Against the Ninja occasionally, or I wake up with it in my head. Against the Ninja.
It's Friends that does it to me.
Friends
for eternity, loyalty, honesty, stay together through thick and thin.
See, the Friends one always reminds me of... Have you seen any of It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia?
I've watched like the odd episode here and there, but I haven't quite got into it.
It's so, so good, honestly. I'm on season 10 and there's like 14 seasons or something. There's so much of it, but each episode's really short, so it's easy to watch quite a few in sequence. And it takes a couple of seasons to get going because Danny DeVito's not there in the first one. But oh my God, once you know the characters and all their different things, it's sensational. And there's one episode where they're kind of trying to make bands to enter some Battle of the Bands thing, and they come up with this song that's like the Day Man and the Night Man, and there's a line about you're a master of karate and friendship for everyone, and the friendship song from Miami Connection always reminds me of that in a similar kind of like bad comedy way. But yeah, It's Always Sunny is great. I'll send you that one clip because it is quite funny. And it's also later then used as a musical where one of the characters, Charlie, writes a whole musical as a ruse to propose to this waitress that he fancies, and then they're all in it and they all sing the song at the end. Oh, it's hard to talk about it. It's so good.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I think maybe should we try and get back to Coming to America?
Yeah, definitely, definitely.
What else do you have to say about this movie?
I wrote down that I thought the concept was really, really good, and it's a very, very fertile idea for comedy, but just that it seemed a bit rushed and cheaply executed, and that I started to like it more when the romantic plot emerged, because you felt like a genuine connection between them, and that was really nice. But the I'm gonna sneeze. The romantic plot was sidelined in favor of kind of cheap gags, and that never quite built up to the point where it felt really meaningful. And then I felt like he chickened out a bit at the end, because he kind of follows her and chases her down, and they're on the subway and they have that kind of conversation, and then she goes, and then it cuts to a scene in Africa of the wedding, and you think that he's marrying the arranged marriage bride, but it's her, and then suddenly she's there, and there's no explanation as to why she changed her mind or anything. It's just suddenly she's there, and you're like, oh, fine. Because that is kind of quite funny in itself as like a filmic trolling of your expectations of the plot. But yeah, I still thought that was a bit cheap.
Yeah, it's one of those things though, where like a lot of people criticized the third Christopher Nolan Batman movie, where they're like, oh, Batman, he managed to get from the other side of the world to Gotham in the space of 48 hours. How did he manage to do that? It's like, the answer is, he's bloody Batman. He can do whatever he likes. And like, in Coming to America at the end, I thought, oh, wow, they managed to sort that out somehow without him finding out. And then I realized, wait, no, James L. Jones is the king of an incredibly rich country. He could have just called her up and said, yo, I'm going to pay for your tickets out here if you do want to come. And she could have said, okay.
Yeah. But she didn't want him for his money.
That could have been... No, she didn't. But then at the end, she realised she did want to be princess of an entire country. Because, you know, who doesn't?
Yeah, exactly. You would want to.
And I think that's a really... I think that is a really funny line, actually. Where at the end he's like, oh, are you sure you don't want me to... You don't want us to give all this up and go back to Queens? And he's just like, no, I think I'll be all right.
Yeah. The one thing that I really liked is that it's the mum who sort of is the one giving the good advice, whereas it's a sort of battle of the dads in the end, where eventually suddenly Mr. McDowell turns on James Earl Jones after he starts dissing his daughter, and they're kind of arguing about it, but it's the mum who cuts through and talks sense. And I liked that part of it because it was sort of moving towards dispensing with tradition, and that as a message is positive, because it's obviously dispensing with the tradition that you have to have kind of arranged marriages or whatever, that you can't marry for love and that kind of thing. So that was good in the end. I like that the mum eventually got some screen time and some lines, and they were good and meaningful.
Yeah, I think they utilised the sort of parent side of things very well in this film. And it's nice to see her being sort of like the voice of reason and eventually proving to be right at the end of it all. In that, even though her arranged marriage ended up working out quite well in the end, from the sounds of it, it seems like they do love each other very well.
Who wouldn't want to marry a man
that's
who,
not for everybody,
when he travels to America, is literally wearing a lion?
Exactly. Who wouldn't want to marry Darth Vader and Thulsa Doom from Conan the Barbarian? You know. But the other thing that I wanted to point out was just a few of the other very, very funny lines from Coming to America, because it is full of really good, much like other films from the era. It's full of really great just one-liners here and there. So I think the first thing that really made me laugh out loud this time round was when Prince Akeem's getting a bath at the beginning, and then the person who's bathing him, because he has people who bathe him and everything like that, she sort of shouts out, "The royal penis is clean, Your Highness."
Yeah. That is sampled on a rap record that we used to listen to at school, and then no one knew where it came from. And now I finally managed to make that connection, however many 15 years later. But it was a line that we always used to like say around school, because it had been on this rap song. I can't even remember who it is. I think it's Snoop Dogg. But it's like the opening track of the album, and that line just is dropped in there. Yeah, that made me chuckle as well. That's a very, very good. The opening is really, really good from a comic point of view. Not being allowed to
10-15 minutes
shit with the door closed and that kind of thing.
Yeah, the first 10-15 minutes is incredibly funny, and it really sets up his world incredibly well, and it makes you realize why he wants that desperation to go out and see other places. It's like the male version of Jasmine from Disney's Aladdin.
Yeah, basically. It's like, because the one piece of criticism that I did read that was critical of it was saying that it seems a bit derogatory and colonial to imply that he can't find an intelligent woman in Africa. But of course, the setup is that he's not allowed to find women for himself. But his thought is that I'll go to America rather than saying to my dad, I'll go and look across the rest of our beautiful country to try and find an intelligent woman. So yeah, it's kind of to do with the setup there, I guess. But potentially
problematic. Yeah, exactly. I think there's quite a lot of nitpicking that isn't necessarily even subconscious colonialism and things like that, because the whole point of it is that he's not allowed to do these things. It's never implied that it's not possible for him to find someone like that, as shown by the marriage between his mum and dad, where she is a very strong woman who has a lot of her own opinions and who is able to talk back to her husband, who's the king of the country.
Yeah.
It's just that the entire sort of like focus on his marriage is that everyone expects that he should have someone who is entirely compliant to what he wants, which isn't the way that romance works.
Yeah. So it's good that it's sending up that, even though for the most part in the film, women have little to no agency. And especially with Lisa, you really, really wonder why she's dating the hair model guy when she seems very nice and intelligent and he's clearly a massive dick. And there are bits when he does like dickhead things, like he throws the shake at Akeem and it goes all over him, and she has clearly seen it but chosen to ignore it, and you're like, that's a really horrible thing to do. Why are you going out with this asshole?
And again, it comes down to the theme of the film, in that it's about people whose family pressures won't allow them to step outside of what is expected of them. So he's very rich, he's very popular, he's from the neighborhood, and so together they would be their own kind of royal couple for Queens. And so the expectation is that she has to be with him because that's what's expected.
Yeah.
But she doesn't have the option that Prince Akeem had, to go off to the other side of the world with thousands and thousands of dollars, because that's just not possible for her because of her upbringing.
And Akeem doesn't try and romance her by being a prince either. but he doesn't try to buy her, which is the main thing. And at times you think, oh, well, why don't you just like give her your money, tell her you're a prince and you've got all this stuff, and then try and get that across, because that's you and that's authentic as well. But you realize that he's trying to perform a different kind of authenticity.
Yeah, exactly. And like, obviously that then ends up being problematic in general for their relationship, because he's been lying to her about his history and everything like that. But in a way, it's much nicer this way around than it is the other way, if he was pretending to be something he's not.
Yeah.
To try and seem that he's a greater person, has a greater upbringing than he had before.
Yeah. So the one bit that did make me laugh out loud was when he's left... what's Arsenio Hall's character called? It's something... Semi. He's left Semi, yeah, Semi. back at the apartment. Semi's decided he's not going to go to work anymore because he doesn't need to. This is all bullshit. And then Akeem comes back and opens the door, and Semi's like kitted out the flat with all this lavish stuff, and he's just sitting there watching TV in a hot tub. And that,
yeah, that great.
Hit me. I didn't expect that at all. And it's like, can you even have a hot tub inside an apartment?
I don't know how they managed to plummet without anybody noticing, and in such a short amount of time.
Yeah.
I admire the effort that went into it.
Yeah. But that made me laugh quite a lot. And then when he takes her out on the date, and he's got all the money in like a McDonald's bag, and he gives it to a homeless guy. And the two homeless guys are called Randolph and Mortimer. And it's like, why did you have to name it? That adds absolutely nothing to the plot whatsoever. But it is really funny. Randolph.
That is a Randolph, reference to trading places.
Ah, right. Okay. Yeah, I haven't seen that in such a long time.
So at the end of Trading Places, the two millionaires who put that bet on in the first instance lose all their money. And that's the two millionaires. So then,
right, of course. Yeah.
It's giving them all this money that they can then use to... And then that's why they say, like, let's have lunch and stuff like that, Ian.
Of course, yeah. It's been such a long time since I talked about Trading Places, since I watched Trading Places. We should,
It's been a while. It's been a while since I saw it as well, actually.
Yeah. But that was good. Randolph and Mortimer.
And, yeah, one of the other things that I thought was great was the landlord, played by the guy from The Wire. So when he brings them into the apartment block, and then the guy just falls down the stairs and is unconscious. And he's like, hey, your rent's due. Don't you be pulling that falling down the stairs crap on me. He always tries the same thing every month.
Yeah. It's all very good. Very good. Very good swearing. Well-timed fucks.
Yes, yeah. There's some good fucks in this film.
Yeah. I have to say a very commendable baseball thing. The taxi driver, when they get there, he's wearing a Mets hat, which is appropriate to the fact that he's going to take them to Queens, because the Mets play in Queens, but are a much less popular team than the Yankees. So if it was a stereotypical portrayal of New York, could have just gone straight in with the Yankees and it probably would have been fine, but they chose the Mets. Mm-hmm. Root for the underdog.
And no one likes the Yankees.
Apart from, like, all of Claire's family.
They're the Manchester United of baseball.
Yes, exactly.
Like the New England Patriots.
Yeah.
They're the one that are very popular, but that nobody except those who likes them.
Yep, that's pretty much exactly it. Although the Yankees have a thing with a partnership with Man City, or at least they used to.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if they do anymore.
But... they should really team up with Manchester United and just have all of them together. Paris Saint-Germain, the same.
Mm-hmm.
Just the generally loathed clubs for those who aren't actual fans of them.
Yeah. So yeah, it was good that he was wearing a Mets hat. There was only one other bad thing that I want to talk about, which is the scene when they first go to the bar, and there's sort of this parade of strange women. And that was quite an unfortunate scene where it seemed to be just like transphobic and mocking the mentally ill and that kind of thing, which obviously was a bit unpalatable. But it didn't spoil it overall. But there's a lot of stuff in there where you just think, could have done without that.
Eddie Murphy's not got the greatest record when it comes to homophobia and transphobia. It's
no, he does not.
It's, yeah. It's one of the things that I prefer him being an actor to being a stand-up, because every so often in the stand-up you get the old awkward jokes that have not aged incredibly well.
Yeah.
Whereas at least in the movies, it's for a very brief moment and then you're onto something else.
It's a shame, because a lot of his stand-up is really good and there's so much great comic timing in there. And, you know, he's a very, very important and influential stand-up comic. But yeah, a lot of the content is very unsavory and problematic. And yeah.
And of course, there was the whole... It's funny because there's a lot of transphobia and homophobia in early Eddie Murphy stuff. But then he had this... he had this very big scandal. I don't know if you remember, with transgender prostitutes and things like that.
Yeah, I do.
And yeah, it's he's had a very strange life, Eddie Murphy, I think, from sort of like very sort of risque humor, embroiled in all these very big scandals as well. But then sort of like his lasting legacy for a lot of people is the voice of Donkey and Shrek. Yeah. and like stuff like Norbit and the Nutty Professor and stuff like that. It's yeah, it's had a very weird career.
I never saw Norbit.
In general,
I think I did see the
Nutty
Professor.
No, I never saw Norbit either.
Which I remember laughing at when I was maybe 12.
I saw The Adventures of Pluto Nash, or at least I saw 10 minutes of it and then turned it off. I don't know if you remember that.
What the hell is The Adventures of Pluto Nash? I've never even heard of that.
It is a sci-fi comedy with him in, and it's one of the biggest box office bombs of all time.
Oh, okay.
An absolute critical fiasco that lost loads of money. And sort of like, it should have been great. It had a really good, like, it had a really strong cast, you know, with Eddie Murphy. It was directed by the guy who did City Slickers and who did Tremors.
Oh, yeah.
A director called Ron Underwood. And you thought like, oh yeah, that seems like it could be a good match, but no. it did not go well at all.
Oh wow, okay.
Yeah, so like it did a lot to damage a lot of people's careers, and Eddie Murphy seems to be the only one who's really come out entirely unscathed.
Wow, well done him.
Yes. Not so well done Rosario Dawson or Randy Quaid, who did not manage to escape from the clutches of Pluto Nash quite as successfully.
Yeah. So yeah, I think that context of Eddie Murphy was very much in the back of my mind as well. I think I went into it wanting to like it, but also very much expecting it to be as problematic as the man himself, and then I found that in it, for sure. Whereas maybe you were more optimistic and had that childhood nostalgia.
Yeah, I didn't necessarily... I've never been sort of like super in love with Eddie Murphy as an actor, more so very much enjoyed the movies that he's been in. And so, yeah, I didn't necessarily find it as awkward, and I didn't feel that it crossed the lines that now wouldn't be acceptable. Because like I said, I do think it kind of... It subverted expectations in ways that you wouldn't necessarily expect. And I think a lot of the time it was just playing up to pastiches rather than just solidifying them with another story that tries to tell the same thing. I think it was being deliberately like subversive, as it were.
Yeah, I think that's true. And when you look at how it was subverting other things, e.g., corporate greed and American culture in the form of McDonald's, it did that really well. And it's really interesting that apparently during the filming of it, they got permission to have McDowell's and the golden arcs and whatever from McDonald's in advance, so it was all sorted out. But it didn't quite get down the chain of command in McDonald's that this had happened, so someone saw the film set from McDonald's and came down and started taking pictures, and then they used that as a parodic element in the film. But then they also...
Oh, right, I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's quite an interesting bit of background trivia. There's also a really good moment as well when you catch Mr. McDowell in the office and he's reading the McDonald's like handbook. That tickled me quite a lot as well.
Yeah. Yeah, that was very funny. I'd say that he's the standout star of the movie.
Yeah.
If I had to choose one person who I enjoyed more than anybody else, I think it would be John Amos.
He's very good, and it's really good how he turns as soon as he thinks that Akeem has money, or he immediately like just becomes a completely different person. That sends up the greed of people and their expectations quite well, I think.
Yeah, it's great. He's great in general, and I'd quite happily have watched more of him in this film.
And we of course have Eddie Murphy doing his thing of playing like 15 different characters all in the same film, which gave me an idea for Sensations, which is that if any of our actors drop out, or if we have trouble getting people, or it goes into development hell or whatever, all we really need is Guy Fieri, and we can just get Guy Fieri to play all of the characters.
It's true. I've often thought about how much I'd enjoy watching an Arnold Schwarzenegger movie where Arnold Schwarzenegger played every single character in the film.
Yes, definitely.
I think this could work quite well. Is Sensations could have various Guy Fieri's scattered throughout. You could be a bit like John Malkovich.
Being Guy Fieri.
Being Guy Fieri.
I bet someone's done that. I'm just going to quickly type that into Google to check whether someone has made that image, of the John Malkovich face with Guy Fieri.
If not, I think it really needs to happen.
Yeah. Almost as much as your rescoring the Bridges of Madison County with Trent Reznor music. No one, I've typed in being Guy Fieri and no one appears to have made that image, so... I think, we've got our work cut out for the next week. But there is a picture of Drake with Guy Fieri's hair. I'm trying to hold it up. There we go.
I'm doing a quick Google search.
He knows when that hotline bling.
He know when that hot dog bling.
That was such an obvious pun on that, and I didn't think of it at all. It's been a long week. I haven't been sleeping that well. Have you?
Wait, hold on. Drake did some kind of shout out to Guy Fieri.
What?
And yeah, the in his mixtape, if you're reading this, it's too late.
Yeah.
He makes a reference to Fieri. He says, "Fieri, I'm in the kitchen. I'm a magician."
No way.
And apparently, they did like a charity fundraiser where they cooked together. So there is a picture of Guy Fieri and Drake cooking together.
No way.
Wearing chef's clothes. Yeah.
That is awesome. Put that in the show notes for sure.
This has totally blown my mind. This is incredible. So this does mean that we have a road in for Drake.
Oh my God.
To be in Sensations as well.
That would be amazing. I love Drake. He's great. Good boy.
He is incredible.
Yeah. He could make a dish with passion fruit in it.
This is all coming together. Do you reckon that he'd be able to do a mashup with Smashed Biscuits as well?
Oh, hell yeah. That would be amazing. Definitely. It would be a very weird crossover, but I reckon he could pull it off.
It would, but yeah. It would be a modern version of Walk This Way.
Yeah. I can't think of any kind of pun to deal with food and Walk This Way. Apart from way, as in curds and whey.
Walk this wafer thin mint.
Walk this wafer.
Walk this wafer. I'm sure we're missing a very obvious one, but hey, I'm out. Do you have anything else you'd like to say about trading places, about coming to America?
See, there is. You wanted it to be trading places, but it wasn't.
I did want it to be trading places.
That's kind of the point. I think that's pretty much it. I think I've said everything. There was a lot of stuff to like, but the comedy was, there were, apart from some isolated bits, the comedy was a little bit flat and didn't quite land. Overall, I still feel kind of lukewarm towards it, but I appreciate it more having spoken to you about it, I think.
Oh, cool. I'm glad I've managed to bully you a little bit into liking it.
No, it's all about perspective, isn't it? About, you know, whether, you know, your perspective is always one made in isolation when you talk to other people. It's good to be able to assess that.
Yeah, I think so too.
Have you thought of a rating scale?
Yeah, I didn't. Oh, I don't know. I was thinking, how many Big Mike's burgers out of 20?
Yeah, special sauce.
Or maybe how many rose petals on the floor?
Oh yeah, yeah. That's loads. I was just going to go with how many bars of sexual chocolate.
Oh, okay, yeah, there we go. That's the winner. That's money.
That's money. Now, I hear a lot of rating scales, but that is the best rating scale that I've ever heard.
Disclaimer at the bottom as you say that, that says Paddy Johnston is a shareholder in this particular rating scale.
Yeah, we are legally obliged to point out that I have shares in Sexual Chocolate Limited. I'm going to give it a 10. 10 out of 20.
10 out of 20?
It was halfway. Wow. There.
This is your JV.
Yeah. Yeah, it's my Bon. My boy Bon.
It's your Bon.
My John Bonathan Jovi. That's his real name.
I think 15 bars of sexual chocolate.
Cool.
Out of 20. I still like this movie a lot. I don't think it's... I didn't enjoy it as much as I did when I was younger. And I don't think it has as strong a place in my heart as the likes of Blues Brothers or Three Amigos. But I think it's still a real standout of the decade.
Yeah. And it's nice that it came out the year that we were born.
Yeah, yeah.
Cool. So I just have one bit of follow-up on the She's All That episode, so a few episodes ago, on the American Simon problem, which is that, as we established, or it's Adam's friend of the podcast, Adam Molesky's theory that there are no Americans called Simon. Our good friend Tracy Dunham has emailed in with an American Simon for us. So this guy, I'd never heard of him, but his name is Simon Rex. I'm on his Wikipedia page right now. I'm just going to read you the first line. It says, or the first paragraph, it says, Simon Rex Cutright, known as Dirt Nasty, born July 20th, 1974, is an American actor, comedian, rapper, record producer, model, and former VJ. Rising to fame as an MTV VJ, Rex turned rapper and comedian under an alter ego, Dirt Nasty, and received a cult following on social media websites. As an actor, he starred as Jeff Campbell in the first season of What I Like About You, as George Logan in Scary Movie 3 and 4, as Dan Sanders in 5, and as Derek in National Lampoon's Pledge This. Now, I have never heard of this man, but I imagine you might be someone who might have seen Scary Movie 3 or 4 out of morbid interest.
I have seen Scary Movie 3 out of morbid interest, and I know exactly who this guy is, because I'm looking at him now. I had no idea of his name, but he's in this terrible other parody of slasher movies called Shriek If You Know What I Did Last Friday the 13th. Which
good
is
title.
Yeah, it's possibly worse than Scary Movie, but it's a film that I kind of enjoy almost as much in a kind of bad movie comfort watch way. And yeah, so I know exactly who this guy is. Oh my God. Yeah.
Yeah.
He's called Simon.
A legit American Simon.
He is. I think this will get a kick. You'll get a kick out of this. His character name in Shriek, If You Know What I Did Last Friday the 13th, is Slabo Beef.
How do you spell Slabo?
So it's Slab and then O Beef, like an Irish name.
Good. Good, strong Irish name. That's what I like to hear.
Yeah. Yeah, wow. Thank you very much for informing us about this other Simon.
Yeah.
It's not only been an interesting piece of trivia, but it's brought back in huge swathes of nostalgia for me. So thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you, Tracy. You've successfully disproven a theory. That's good. That's what we like to call effective peer review. But I'm afraid I don't think I have the stomach for a lot of this guy's work. I think I have. I do not want to waste my time on this.
He is. I think maybe we should watch Shriek, If You Know What I Did Last Friday the 13th at some point, because it does actually include loads of actors who are in other stuff that's vastly superior to it. So yeah, it's quite an interesting movie. I'm just looking at further stuff from Simon Rex. And in 2016, he was in a movie called Halloween.
Halloween.
And I think it's about a horror movie about marijuana.
You don't say. Oh, yeah, that's one of the ones where you can actually click through to find out more about the film, unlike the majority of his filmography. Wait. 2004, The Karate Dog. Oh, my God.
You what, mate?
Oh, my fucking God. The Karate Dog is a 2004 television film directed by Bob Clark. It stars Chevy Chase as the voice of Cho-Cho, Simon Rex, Trump supporter John Voight, and Jamie Presley. No way.
Yeah. Trump supporter John Voight.
Plot. It's got the note, this section needs expansion. A talking dog named Cho-Cho teams up with a police detective named Peter Fowler to solve the murder of his owner, Chin Lee. Oh, and he's an Asian karate dog. Okay, that sounds like it might be offensive.
It might need expansion, but that certainly sounds like that's about as much effort as went into writing the script to the film.
Yeah. Chevy Chase, though.
Yeah, and John Voight. I mean, John Voight has gone off the deep end a little bit.
But, yeah, he's a bit of a Clint Eastwood yelling at a chair type now, isn't he, John Voight?
Yeah, I think he's more nasty than Clint Eastwood, though. It's a shame for John Voight is that he's been in all of these incredible movies over the years, such as like Midnight Cowboy, for instance, is a phenomenal film, and Deliverance and stuff like that. But my lasting memory of John Voight is always going to be Anaconda. The creature feature horror movie starring Jennifer Lopez and Ice Cube, where a giant anaconda starts eating people. And that's what I'm always going to remember John Voight for. And he plays the very, very creepy, like evil villain who wants to capture the anaconda and doesn't care who gets in his way. And he puts on this kind of absurd accent that could be from anywhere in the world. It's almost like a more South American version of Tommy Wiseau. it's incredible. His performance in that film is great.
That's fantastic.
A few years ago, I put together a montage of all of the creepiest moments of John Voight in that movie, which is up on YouTube somewhere.
Oh, cool.
And yeah, he's magnificent in that film.
Good work.
If I can find it, we'll put that in the show notes so you can see all of the creepy John Voight anaconda moments.
Cool. I'm glad I found another bad dog film to watch, because me and Adam have already had one weekend where we only watched bad dog films, or yeah, so bad they're so good dog films, or films starring talking dogs, that kind of thing. We can add this one to the ones. More and more of them just keep on emerging. It's like actually a really, really amazing kind of sub-genre in and of itself. So you've got Sherlock Bones, Cool Dog, what else, Underdog, we didn't watch that one at the time. Maybe it was just Sherlock Bones and Cool Dog, but there are quite a few of them and they're all brilliant. But yeah, I'm going to go watch the trailer Karate Dog.
What about the millions upon millions of Air Bud sequels?
Oh, man. See, Air Bud's cute, though. Like, Air Bud's a very, very adorable dog. I did actually watch the baseball one, which is called Golden Receiver, when I was looking for some inspiration. I think that's Air Bud 7. But yeah, they definitely fall into that genre and are kind of, classics of the genre. But they're the mainstream examples of the genre, I think. Some of the other ones are maybe the more indie hits. But yeah, I got time for Air Bud and for Air Pups as well. Is it Air Pups or Air Buddies, which is like the puppies? And they are Christmas ones. We started watching one once, which is like Air Buddies and Santa Paws or whatever. And it had Santa coming to New York and then Santa got mugged. And then Claire was like, I can't watch this. We've got to turn it off.
Is that out of concern for Santa Claus or out of just it's so bad that she has to leave the room?
Both. Bit of both. I mean, obviously he got mugged so that a bunch of cute puppies could come and save him, but she wasn't waiting around for the puppies to show up. She was like, I don't want to see Santa getting mugged, which is fair.
It could be worse. It could be Air Bud goes deep south and Santa Claus happens to be part of the crew that gets attacked in Deliverance.
Yeah.
Nobody wants to see that. I'm personally holding out hope for Air Bud 79, which is where he becomes an international assassin.
Yeah, crossbow. They haven't done archery yet, as far as I know.
Yeah, you know, it's slowly start getting his spy training up. Yeah. And then he could do like a crossover with Cats and Dogs, apart from make it incredibly violent and ask Quentin Tarantino to direct.
Yeah, there you go. This shit writes itself. That would almost certainly, definitely be better than whatever nonsense Tarantino is working on right now.
Do you reckon that he should... So he's making this movie about the Manson murders. Do you reckon That's he right. should make it and all of the cast members should be dogs?
Yeah. Yeah. That's the only thing that could get me to want to see a Tarantino film in the cinema is if it was an all-dog cast.
Django Unleashed.
The Hateful Litter of Eight.
Inglorious Bitches.
Reservoir Dogs. Pup Fiction.
This shit it's, writes itself.
It's too easy. It's just too easy.
Come on, Tarantino, mate. Sort it out.
Get your fucking dog shit together.
You need to remake your entire back catalogue of films with dogs.
Yeah. It's offensive to me that he isn't doing that already, to be honest.
One day, like, history's going to look back at Tarantino and say, you know, he was all right, but where are all the fucking dog movies?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, this has been fun. I feel like, yeah, we could have a whole other podcast about bad dog films. But yeah, if one of these has like a vaguely romantic plot in it, I'm going to shoehorn it in at some point.
All right.
Yeah,
I agree.
We're almost 15 episodes in. This is the point at which we start to really properly drift.
Are there any movies about like conspiracy theories that also have dogs in?
Can we
combine all elements into one?
There's got to be. I think Underdog has some kind of alien subplot as well. Like the dog is actually an alien or something. So that's conspiracy theory territory, I guess.
That's the one where it's basically Superman but a dog, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's Underdog.
Yeah. It's not basically. Yeah. That is exactly the plot of the film.
All right, okay.
Even down to, I think there's like a cat Lex Luthor or some shit.
Oh my God, I've just looked at the IMDb page. What the hell is Peter Dinklage doing?
I know.
In this movie.
It's pre-Game of Thrones as well, isn't it? Peter Dinklage.
Patrick Warburton?
Who's that?
Oh my God. Amy Adams.
I know. Lovely, lovely Amy Adams.
Oh my God. This is unbelievable. What are all these people doing in a film about a dog superhero?
Well, wouldn't you want to be in a film about a dog superhero?
Not necessarily.
your silence was speaking volumes.
Why would I want to be in a film about a dog superhero when I could rather be in a world with dog superheroes?
That's true.
That's my dream. Yeah. Got to think big.
We've got to make it happen. Yeah. Once with all the money that we make off of sensations, that's when we're going to get so rich that we're going to be able to build worlds, and that's how we're going to make it happen.
I thought we were just going to start doing terrible science experiments where we try and create dog superheroes.
Yeah. It'll get to the point where we'll make the film, but we won't be able to put the disclaimer that says no dogs were harmed in the making of this film, because it will be untrue. You know what? I saw a tweet this week.
I've made myself sad.
I saw a tweet earlier saying that there's some kind of island off the coast of Scotland that's on sale for $325,000. So,
we
could buy that island, get a bunch of dogs, put them in capes, superhero dog island. Done. This is my dream.
I'm all over that plan. Dog Island. Superhero Dog Island.
Superhero Dog Island. Actually, that sounds like a forgotten Sega Genesis, Sega Game Gear game, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Went for the American name.
Created
there
by
God knows what reason. Sega Mega Drive.
Sega Genesis, yeah. Sega Mega Drive.
I think it's because I've been playing it on playing some emulators. And it's always called Genesis on the emulators.
I prefer Mega Drive.
Yeah, me too.
Sounds more shit futuristic than Genesis.
Yeah, and it doesn't remind you of Phil Collins.
Oh, Phil.
That's our nice little ending tangent as well. I think we should wrap it up because we're running long once again. We're running longer every time.
Which is good. I thought we were going to be on time, and then all of the dog chat started.
Yeah. That's the the story that anyone who has ever had a conversation with me will tell you. In fact, I might get that as a quotation on my gravestone.
I think at your funeral as well, you need to the funeral needs to be like winding up, and then have to have the doors locked, and then a pre-recorded tape of you talking about dogs for 15 minutes has to start.
Yeah.
Or then only when that's finished, that's when people are allowed to leave.
Yeah. Or the officiant comes up and he goes, so who here's seen a Bichon Frise? Fluffy as hell, aren't they? I've got hours worth of this kind of dog material.
Oh man.
Dogs are the best.
Amazing. Great.
Cool. So what is your choice for next time?
Well, I realize that this may well be the last choice I get to make before your incredible wedding day.
It's possible. But the day that this episode goes out will in fact be the day before my wedding.
Yeah. So to get into that frame of mind, both for you and for our listeners, I'm going for The Wedding Singer.
Oh, nice. Okay. That's a good one. I suppose at least we'll probably watch it and get to record before the wedding, so that's good. And that is a film I have seen a number of times and do like, but have not watched in a long time. So that's good.
Yeah, no, I've not seen it in years either, so I'm looking forward. But yeah, I figured we need to get a wedding movie in.
Yep. That's a very good idea. Nice one. And I think we have not covered Adam Sandler yet.
No, this will be our first venture into the terrible filmography of Adam Sandler with one of his good movies.
Yeah, I have a lot of thoughts on Adam Sandler, but we got to save them for next time.
Yes, yes.
Cool. Well, I'll look forward to talking to you about that. So, as always, you can get in touch with us on Twitter at BigBoysDon'tPod. You can email us at BigBoysDon'tCryPodcast@gmail.com. Please do. We always love to hear from you. Any requests, don't worry, we will get to them. We have our long list and such. Any of your thoughts about anything, just let us know. And keep it romantic, y'all.
Alrighty.
Right. See you next time. Bye.